Welcome to TrimTab. Today, I have the good fortune of interviewing Dave Huseby, CEO and co-founder of Cryptid and the community manager for LibP2P. In previous lives, Dave was the security maven for Hyperledger at the Linux Foundation, a senior security engineer at Mozilla, and a senior software engineer on Second Life at Linden Lab. He is an advocate for user sovereignty, which is a moral framework for making engineering and design decisions that give humans agency on the internet. I am honored and humbled to give you a view into his philosophy and the cool tech that he is cooking in the lab at Cryptid. And now, my friends, Dave Huseby. We've got a lot of really radical ideas. They're pretty awesome. Radical in both the sense of like, it's just they're like outside of the norm. Like they're not widely held ideas. I think the zeitgeist is catching up to a lot of the stuff you've been saying. But they're also radical in the sense, like the 60s sense of, you know, if these ideas prove fruitful, they have the potential to like drive significant societal change.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's been hard to narrow down one to kick us off. But I think one of your radical ideas was that there's this movement right now to decentralize the web or re-decentralize the web.
Yeah. Right?
And you've asserted that the web was never decentralized to begin with.
Not at all.
Could you kick us off with that? It's a wild assertion.
So at the risk of losing all of the audience in the first 30 seconds, so you're alluding to a paper I wrote a few years ago about how the web was never decentralized, because we hear constantly at Web3 conferences, oh, we're going to re-decentralize the web, as if it were something that existed that we lost, right? And I think it depends on how you define decentralization. I define decentralization as a function of power, not as computers being spread out, right? This, I know, is an inversion of what everybody talks about now when they say, distributed versus decentralized. But I use decentralized in the terms of the way, or in the way that the founders of the United States used it, right? Decentralization is about power. And when I explain my position, and we're just kind of splitting hairs here, really, but when you use decentralization to mean about power, it's aligned with the way everybody else outside of tech uses the word decentralized. So here's how I look at it. Facebook is distributed. It's hundreds of thousands of computers spread all over the world. They all work together to make one application work. It's called Facebook. That is a distributed computer, but it is not decentralized in the sense that you as a user of Facebook are totally at their mercy. You do not have any power. There's no balance of power between users and Facebook itself. You do not own your data. You can't replace Facebook with an equally functioning system that's run by somebody else. The system itself is not replaceable. So your relationship with Facebook is at their will. There's a power imbalance there. And so it is not a decentralized system, as it were. But to get back to your first part of the question, which is the web wasn't ever really decentralized. It wasn't. It just simply wasn't. The first commercial search engine, the first search engine that commercialized the intelligence gathered by the search terms, existed less than 18 months after the very first web servers went online.
That's wild.
Yes, it is wild. It's a fact that I think many people don't know, and I am of a certain age. I was on the web when it was first started in 1992, 93. In the summer of 1994, I had on my wall a 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that had the web address of every web server in the world written on it. A single piece of paper. There was like 40 web addresses, 50 web addresses. And I experienced the web from its infancy. And I guess the main argument here is that immediately the way to make money on the web was to set up walled gardens like AOL, you know, GeoCities, things like curated experiences on the web. And the whole system itself wasn't really truly decentralized. I'm trying to remember all the points in my paper. I wrote it 2 years ago. So if I remember correctly, the points I made was like the web itself as a decentralized system wasn't fully in control of the users. Like the users themselves didn't necessarily control the data. There was a lot of gatekeepers on setting up your own website, publishing data online and all that stuff was not easy at the beginning. And then it immediately got centralized around search engines and these walled garden experiences. So I don't believe that the web was ever decentralized in the sense that everybody ran their own servers and they all, and you controlled your data and we all worked together to make the web happen. I would actually argue that the web didn't exist until Firefox was launched in 1998, 1999. It was not, this brings up another thing that I've been talking to a lot of people about lately, about links in distributed and decentralized systems, the links that connect the pieces together. So that's like URLs on the web or public key identifiers in peer-to-peer systems. Not to get all crazy here, but what I'm thinking about is when the web was first created, we say the web, right? But back then it was the World Wide Web, and it was not a foregone conclusion that there would be the web. In fact, from 1994 until 2000, AOL had a non-trivial percentage of the people on quote-unquote the web as their customers in a curated experience that was walled off from the rest of the world, essentially, mostly. At the beginning, it was entirely walled off. And then later on, it started to open up. You could actually go to other web pages and things like that. But it was not a foregone conclusion that there would be the web, where every web page was accessible to every user who thought they were on the web. Because anybody that was locked into a walled garden experience was filtered. Their access to the web was filtered by the corporate entity between them and the actual World Wide Web. And it wasn't just AOL. I mean, anybody remember Web TV or, many ISPs like, what was the free one out of Seattle? There was like, it was still dial-up days. It was still the 90s. I can't remember the name, but, I was a user of Eskimo North, and then like 2 miles north of there in Federal Way, Washington was an ISP where you could get free internet access, but it was gatekept, right? You had to watch ads to stay online, and you had, it was a walled garden experience.
That was way ahead of its time.
Freeinternetonline.com or something like that. Freeinternet.com or something like that. Yeah. And it was like a mid 90s kind of thing. These were not alone, right? Like the business of the internet itself was very much corporate driven, even before the web. I mean, CompuServe and AOL before the web, obviously ISP, we were always gatekept. There's always at least an ISP between you and the internet. And there was, when the web came up, that business model extended into the web. And I know I'm rambling a bit here, but the thing that made the web, in my opinion, and I could be totally wrong and I would love feedback on this, but the thing that made the web was the launch of a standards-based browser that we know as Firefox in the late 90s. It asserted that if everybody would just stick to the standards and stop trying to make their own special thing like ActiveX controls in Internet Explorer or whatever, or Java or whatever, that we could have sort of universality. It was standard protocols, standard everything. So if everybody did that, then browsers, at least Firefox, could access every web server in the planet, and it serves as sort of a disintermediation market force, I guess would be the right way to call that. And sure enough, once Firefox started getting traction, it was really a word of mouth campaign. AOL started to open up, these walled gardens started to open up so you could go to other websites, but they didn't work. And then moms would call their kids and say, why can't I go to this website? And they would be, oh, mom, just install Firefox, right? That it was just install Firefox. I said that maybe a million times between the launch of Firefox and, 2004. Like that was always the answer. If there was anything wrong with the internet, just install Firefox. And standards-based web browsers and web servers and web pages became the dominant force. And that is what made the web, the acceptance and penetration of standards-based protocols and data encoding for the web. And so it was never decentralized, first of all, because it was corporate, corporate intermediaries. It was a carryover from the internet-based businesses from the 80s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And then it wasn't until standards really drove that we got away from these walled gardens to the web, right? And that actually is that's where I got one of those principles of user sovereignty, which is like standards, it's open standard data encoding and protocols always.
Let's talk about those. You have these principles of user sovereignty.
Sovereignty?
Sovereignty.
In my head, yeah.
In my head.
It's absolute privacy by default. That's the first one. That one is about design. If you're these are rules for engineers designing decentralized systems.
Let's take a step back.
Sure.
Can you define what user sovereignty, like why that is a thing? And why is it important? Why is that something you think about? And how does that lead into the web? And then we can go and define each of those principles.
Sure. I don't know about you, but I'm pissed off that I access this massive thing called the internet that has the potential to make me way more efficient and have much greater reach in the world, be connected to many more humans in the world, but I have to ask permission to use it. That makes me angry because I don't have to ask permission to go next door to my neighbor and knock on the door and be like, hi, how is it going? You know, have a human connection. I get that there needs to be some economic model to maintain the infrastructure.
What's your definition of asking permission? Is it just like being able to like allowed to create and maintain an account? Or is it like...
Well, up until very recently, if I said the wrong thing on Twitter, not only did I get kicked off of Twitter, but I got kicked off of Google, Facebook. I probably would get kicked off of PayPal. I would probably lose my bank account. Like the internet itself was reaching into the real world from these corporate entities that were cooperating with each other and really impacting everyday people. If I said the wrong thing online, okay, first of all, that just runs counter to everything I believe about free speech, but it also shows that we don't have free and open access. I used to work at Mozilla and I really believe in their mission, which is a free and open web, open and free web for everybody, right? And I think that should extend to the internet itself. I think it necessarily has to, right? If you want an open and free web, you have to have an open and free internet underneath it. And what I meant by having to ask permission is that there is a lot of forces present on the internet today that serve to control the way we use the internet. That's like their primary business model. It's to propagandize to us, to control what we can say, control who we can connect to, that kind of stuff.
When they say they're platforming you and therefore you can't talk to your grandmother, but it's like, she's my grandmother. That was my platform to begin with.
Yeah.
What happened here? How did we lose that level of connection with each other or have these intermediaries in between?
I think that it is a carryover from the only business models we knew on how to make money on an internet, on a network service, right? Like the CompuServe business model strikes again, right? I think that's what it is. Not that CompuServe was bad. I think that these are sort of old modes of operating. You take control of a resource and then you control the users and you farm them for resources, right? Like
accumulate equity in your users' content, their data, and...
Well, and being between them and what they want. You charge them for access to what they want. And I'm not saying that the internet should be free, but we have an open telephone network and we have an open postal service, right? That's supported by taxes and or, you know, utility style business models. I'm actually becoming very sympathetic to the argument that the internet itself should be deemed a utility and we all pay a flat fee and there's very strong controls, legal controls put into place about what you can and cannot do to prevent someone's access to it. Like if I say the wrong thing on Twitter, one of the things I am not kicked off of is the US Postal Service. One of the things I am not kicked off of is the telephone network.
It's interesting that we all take that for granted, but until you said that out loud, it never dawned on me that, you know, when I lose access to my Gmail account, there are all these downstream effects of it, but there's a limit to what those effects are going to be. And like you said, the Postal Service, it doesn't reach to the Postal Service instance, still send mail.
Yeah, I can
still can't, you know, upload videos to YouTube anymore, or, you know, move money on PayPal.
Right. And I am not anti-capitalist at all. In fact, I've, you know, been in many startups and I believe in the VC model to a certain degree. I think it's a healthy way to vet ideas and fail quickly and get new stuff done. I think what we're seeing with the Web3 is a lot of really interesting attempts at new funding models and new community support methods and all that stuff. And I think it's time that we start rethinking about the old CompuServe business model. I hate to pick on them. I loved CompuServe. But I think what we see today is an extension of all of that. You know, corporations coming in, gathering a bunch of users over a centralized service, and then monetizing them in some way or another. And that's what I meant when I originally said, I don't like having to ask for permission, because I feel like a lot of the services I use are controlled by corporate entities, centralized services that monetize me. And if I am no longer valuable to them, they can deny me access to the internet, to their services or whatever. Right.
So you're not sovereign on the internet. You are beholden to these people who've
right.
almost feudalistically taken over these properties and they grant you access.
Yeah. It's actually very interesting that you call it feudalism. I've used the term neo-feudalism.
Neo-feudalism.
Yeah. I mean, the more our society becomes reliant on the internet itself for our means of earning money and feeding ourselves and communicating with our families and our friends, the more this becomes a feudal-like relationship. It might be a little bit different because these are not hereditary lords and ladies that own these spaces. These are corporate entities. So it's almost
their boards of directors and up management chains. And
yeah, but it is definitely a tiered aristocratic society that we're building. Definitely. And I'm not sure that I agree with that.
So we have almost this classist structure where you're beholden to the system administrator, and then whoever happens to control the system administrator controls whatever you're. So I guess that ties back into your six tenets, your principles of. So what is missing in the web that is, like, I guess the game mechanics that have given rise to this odd relationship where we don't own our data, we're beholden to these people, and they can revoke our access at any time, prevent me from communicating with my friends and family. What caused that to manifest?
Well, I don't like to cast stones. I'm going to mix metaphors here. I don't like to criticize a system if I don't take care of my own business first and that I get myself right. I do not like hypocrites. At least be honest about your bias, and I have lots and we'll talk about them. But I wanted to finally write down what I believe after spending many years talking at conferences and meetups and things like that, and people just challenging me on stuff. And one of my friends finally said, "What do you believe in?" Because I had the nickname Dr. No when I was at Mozilla, because I just said no a lot, right? I was involved with a lot of evaluation of product stuff, and it was like, no, we're not going to do that, right? I can't go into it because there were products that were never released. Thank you. But
said no.
Yeah. But I wrote these principles down because I wanted to try to clearly articulate what I follow, the rules I follow when I design decentralized systems or distributed systems. I start off with, okay, it's going to be private by default. So users themselves are private by default. This mirror is real life. You don't know who I am. I walk by you in the street. You don't know who I am by default. I would have to correlate myself. I'd have to give you information. I'd have to have friends say, yeah, this is Dave, and, you know, show you my ID or whatever. I'm free to do that, but it's not done for me automatically, which is how the web is today, right? I go to one website, and on the back end, all of the ad tech platforms and all of the big data vendors are actively correlating who I am, so that whoever I go to, you know, those web servers pay these data farms to know who every one of their users is and all the data they've already accumulated on them. So no matter where I go, if the server is paying for this data, they know everything about me. They've pulled my ID out of my wallet. You know, they've already automatically called all my friends and got all, you know, the scuttlebutt on me and all, you know, like they have all of this information that just follows me everywhere. I can't ever walk into a web property and be anonymous by default. And
that's wild to think about.
So, yeah. So the first principle is just absolute privacy by default. Everything's encrypted and all that stuff. So then the second one is absolute pseudonymity by default, because we don't want anonymity. We want people to be able to build reputations tied to identities, but those identities should be divorced from our real life or from our real identity. That connection to our real identity should be under our control. I should be able, now that Mickey Mouse is in the public domain, I can say this, I should be able to develop as Mickey Mouse. And all of my commits and all of my participation in communities and stuff online, I should be known as Mickey Mouse, right? That should be under my control. I should be able to choose that. Now, in the future, if I wanted to say, okay, no, Mickey Mouse has always been Dave and I can prove it cryptographically or whatever, then that would be my choice too. But I don't, this is a very subtle, but very important point, because the reason why there's this network effect on deplatforming is because of the fact that I'm never pseudonymous on these systems. Like, I go onto Twitter, they know who I am. I go onto Google, they know who I am. And so they can easily correlate me across all these platforms. So if I say the wrong thing on one system and someone gets mad about it, you know, because I have an opinion they don't like or whatever, then I get banned across all these other platforms. And that's because I do not have an individualized pseudonymous identity or, you know, identification or relationship with each of the individual platforms. So if I was Mickey Mouse on Twitter and I was Donald Duck on Google, if I got kicked off of Twitter, it wouldn't necessarily mean I get kicked off on Google, right? So this is a way of breaking the correlation of users across systems.
Which, you said that in the context of being able to like ban someone across properties.
Yeah.
But I think right now in the zeitgeist, there's this tension between, like, I think we just saw it play out with like based Beth Jesus, where they have been running an anonymous account for a long period of time. And that anonymous account started off like EAC, which was this movement, and then was eventually like de-anonymized. And there's this like debate about whether or not Twitter should have anonymity. How do you balance that with bots? But it's more around the context of like, if someone's promoting ideas and thoughts, does the public have a right to know those thoughts? Like, they have a right to know the thoughts, obviously they're being shared, but do they have a right to know the originator of those thoughts? And you're seeing this kind of tension. And like, I guess I like how you've framed this so far of saying this is like how it works in the real world. In your opinion, like, how does that work in the real world? How have we done these things in the past? Where does pseudonymity like lie? And like you said, your definition of privacy went back to founding fathers. Like,
oh yeah.
How does that align with like American ideals around sharing of information? Does that question make sense? Was that coherent?
I think so. I think that if you're an American and you believe in the founding principles of this country, then you should be all for pseudonymous access, and doxing should be a thing you should never demand, and you should frown on it. I would frown on doxing. Here's my evidence.
Okay, let's go.
Benjamin Franklin
wrote
As Silence Do Good, as many of you know from the National Treasure movies and whatever, but in the 1620s, started writing these fairly salacious articles, right? Or 1720s. I'm getting my years mixed up. 1720s, because he was alive in the founding in 1776. So, it's the 1720s, he starts writing letters under a pen name, Silence Do Good, which were salacious and sort of got him accustomed to this playing a role. And it fed into all of his later political rabble rousing against the crown. You got to realize, his first Silence Do Good letter was 50, almost 60 years before the Declaration of Independence. So there was 6 decades of doing the 1700s equivalent of anonymous shit posting on the internet, right? He was writing these things like the famous the cartoon of Unite or Die, the chopped up snake, or he wrote a pamphlet called Common Sense. I think it's Common Sense. I don't know. I'm getting these all mixed up, and history buffs are going to be like, no, that's not what it's called. He wrote a bunch of stuff about basically sovereign citizenship. We should have the right to control the laws and the rules that bind us and govern our societies at all levels should be under the control of the people. Sound familiar? And this was all during the six decades prior to the founding of this country, to the Declaration of Independence. And it wasn't just him. I mean, during the debates about the formation of the current federal constitution, right? United States has had two constitutions, right? The Articles of Confederation and now our current constitution. So during the Articles of Confederation, and we were talking about the new constitution, there was a lot of writing back and forth, people arguing effectively, basically what we do on Twitter today, about how this new constitution should look. And politicians like John Jay, they wrote under pseudonyms like Publius. Right? This is a proud American tradition. People writing their mind, writing, speaking their mind through writing and interacting in a public way under a pseudonym. This has always been part and parcel of how we do politics in this country. And there's another amazing fact that's somewhat tied to this that I love to drag out anytime anybody says we shouldn't have encryption. And I sent this to you in this article I wrote. When James Madison himself was writing letters to Thomas Jefferson about the Bill of Rights, so he was writing the Bill of Rights. This was post ratification of the federal constitution, or it was in the process of being ratified. It was before all of the state legislatures to ratify it as the constitution. And the first session of Congress, as we know it today, hadn't taken place. And they were, Madison was trying to write the Bill of Rights, and he was trying to get it correct. And he talked a lot to Thomas Jefferson because it was based a lot on like, you know, the writings that Thomas Jefferson had done in Virginia about establishing the basic rights of, you know, writing down our God-given rights and to establish them in the supreme law of the land so that certain things the government couldn't do. It's like, let's get all the constraining requirements into this. Okay. So they were talking back and forth through letters. And at the time it was really common for postmasters to actually open mail and read it. And Thomas Jefferson,
that's wild to think.
Yeah.
That's unfathomable. Now.
That's why it's actually, it's one of the first laws that was ever passed by Congress was to make it a felony to open people's mail. And this is why the Postal Service is part of this country, right? Benjamin Franklin was the first postmaster. He was really really into we need to have private and open and unmolested communication amongst the people, because they really believed that the only way this would ever work is if we were able to speak our minds, to talk to whoever we wanted, to group together in however way we wanted, and to have those communications be secure.
So at this time, they didn't have that.
No. They absolutely did, because the letters that Madison wrote to Jefferson were encrypted. They were encrypted using a wheel cipher system that Thomas Jefferson himself had devised. And it's very similar to the way the Enigma worked in World War II. But it was like a one-time pad, and you arrange these disks, and then it would translate words into numbers, and you would just write numbers instead of the words. And then the keyword would be done on the other end, and you could translate the numbers back to the words. And it's tedious. And so the letter discussing the Bill of Rights, discussing the introduction of the Bill of Rights in the first session of Congress to Thomas Jefferson from Madison, is partially encrypted. Guess what he encrypted? He didn't encrypt the stuff about the Bill of Rights, and he didn't even encrypt the stuff about his plans of, hey, we're going to introduce it, we're going to have a pretty vigorous debate, blah, 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 all this other stuff. The only things in that letter that he encrypted was him talking shit about other politicians. Things that probably would have landed him in a duel.
Oh, that's true. I thought that I laughed at first, but yeah, there are real consequences for those words.
They were 100% real consequences for talking crap about other people, right? And so the parts are like, well, the gentleman from this state is, you know, cantankerous a-hole, you know? And it's like, if you read it, it's silly language, and you're like, why would anybody be so mad about that? But language was much more refined back then, and slights in, you know, about your integrity were taken extremely seriously. And so those parts are encrypted. Anyway, this was a long tangent just to point out that
this is awesome.
The discussion about the Bill of Rights itself was encrypted with an encryption system that was not breakable by any government on the planet of the Earth at the time.
You're saying we wouldn't have had the institutions we have today if Benjamin Franklin wasn't slinging dank memes on the dark web.
Exactly. And Madison was encrypting all of his, and he was doing end-to-end encryption with Thomas Jefferson.
So we have user privacy by default, and then we have the right to pin handles by default.
Pseudonymity. The next thing is open and standard protocols and data encoding.
This goes back to the Firefox. How do you get adoption?
Right. Standardization breaks down walled gardens. It breaks down, it's a disintermediating factor.
So if I want to be able to take my data somewhere, that data has to be standards based. Otherwise, I guess, otherwise we're all reverse engineering everything that we have, even if it's open. Yeah.
Yeah. I often argue that email is the most decentralized system on the internet. Why? It's also the most user sovereign too, because I can use a false name. I can change email addresses, all this stuff. I can encrypt it. But if I don't like Gmail, I can use an open source tool to sync all of my email locally. And then I can use the same open source tool to go to another email provider like Fastmail and upload that email to Fastmail. Like my entire email history, I can pull down from Google, from Gmail, and I can upload my entire email history into Fastmail using totally open free software. And I don't lose service at all. And if I own my domain name that I'm using to route my email to Gmail and I just repoint it over to, you know, I point it over to Fastmail, I have no loss in service. No loss in data, and I can completely replace Gmail with Fastmail.
I'm realizing I've migrated email providers and I haven't done what you just did, and I still keep around my old email account just in case I need access to it.
I'll show you how to do it.
Probably move it.
MBSync.
MBSync.
Yeah, it's an open source tool that it's really handy for doing IMAP syncing for if you use Mutt or something local for your email. And it will pull everything down into a standard format like Mbox or MailDir. And then you can use it also to push mail up to an IMAP server. So the whole thing is standard. Okay. IMAP's a standard protocol. This data store, the emails themselves are standardized the way they're encoded. Storing them local is a standard, MailDir or Mbox files. And then again, using IMAP to upload it, also a standard protocol. Because that entire process is standardized, both for file formats and protocols, I now have 100% replaceability of the actual corporate service. I'm okay with corporate services existing, but I want them to be replaceable. If Facebook sucks, I should be able to just swap in Mastodon and not lose anything.
Is there a difference in your mind between fungibility and replaceability in the sense of if like an email provider, I imagine you have like a set of progressive enhancements on top of these things. Do those have to also be open in your opinion? Or is it as long as my data is portable and people can build experiences on top of it, that's sufficient? Does that,
Make sense? Yeah. Yes. So there's sort of like, I want the minimum viable product replaceable. I think if I had to narrow it down to something very specific, I think the minimum viable product should be standardized and that should be the service provider should be replaceable. Now I get that like Gmail has all these other features and I know Fastmail has a bunch of features. That's the innovation of the market. That's the froth on top, but the actual part that is the service itself, email itself should be standardized and all the providers of email should be interchangeable, at least at the basic level.
So users are sovereign over their data, not necessarily the experience that's enabled by the data, but they're sovereign over the data itself.
Correct. And and that gets to the next thing, which is like, I want revocable consent-based interactions. So if I'm on, say, Gmail and they're providing me a great basic email and then they say, oh, we're going to do this other thing, and that other thing involves violating my privacy in my terms, right? That might not violate someone else's privacy because everybody has their own sense of privacy, what they're okay and not okay with sharing. But if they're going to tack this new feature set on and it's going to do things with my personal data, they need to ask me. They need to get my consent. And we're already seeing a lot of this. I mean, GDPR and all this stuff. But then I should be able to revoke it and also force delete.
Interesting. I'm realizing now, like, I get an email from my bank and my bank's like, hey, we're updating our terms of service. You have 60 days to disagree with this and letter. I've never received that from any of my internet service providers. They're just like, hey, we've updated our terms of service. If you don't like it, I'm sorry, you've lost access to, you can leave. We still have all of your data. We still have all the things you've purchased. You don't get those back. So you're now beholden to our terms.
Yeah. There's a lot of innovation that needs to happen here, but I believe it's possible because it does exist in some realms, right? And so,
it being possible is something I want to dig into. I think we still have two other things, but it being possible is a nice bullhead into the next topic.
Yeah. So then the other ones, the last two real quick are, strong open encryption always. So all the data at rest, all the data in motion should be encrypted, should be under my control. And then what, not who, for authorization.
Dig into that a bit. This is a mind blower for me.
Okay, because I wrote another article called How Elon Could Transform Twitter with Pseudonymous Free Speech and Solve the Bot Problem All at the Same Time, right? And we can dig into that.
I love how radical your ideas are. They're never small. You don't have small ideas.
Well, we're tinkering with the fabric of society, and I think to ignore that is foolish.
That's profound. And it's true. It's profound because it's true.
Yeah.
That's what these systems do.
So, and when you're tinkering with the fabric of society, you're doing things like writing constitutions. It's stuff that affects everybody. So if we're designing metastable networks that use provenance-based identity, we're building systems that do not have any fixed infrastructure, that give total control, or has total IAM with social recovery that's all done in cryptography. And you build systems that basically are unassailable. They are the star fort of the internet because they don't have any fixed infrastructure. Everybody is private. All of the principles of user sovereignty are followed, right? Everybody is encrypted. Everybody is pseudonymous. Everything is a standard protocol. All the services are replaceable. So it is really, I call them metastable networks, but they're ephemeral, right? There's nothing to attack. So when we're applying all of these principles and actually building systems, we're going to be able to build systems that use the internet in a way that doesn't require permission. As long as packets can move, as long as messages can move, and there are a million different ways to send messages on the internet. I could even be posting random text in public forums and then point you towards a public forum and you look for certain little markers and pull like that. There's all a million different ways to do surreptitious channels over the internet. And so as long as we can pass messages, you and I could do whatever we do today without any centralized services and without any intermediate like corporate anything or even government or any centralized systems. And we could dig into that, but what not who really means that when deciding if a client can activate a service, you need to really just limit the authorization to what is true about them. What can they prove? Not who they are. For instance, I should be able to trade Bitcoins for US dollars on USDC on a DeFi platform so long as I can prove which legal jurisdiction I'm under and that I meet all of the financial regulatory requirements to do that particular transaction in that particular legal jurisdiction. So I'm a citizen of the United States. I have to pass a KYC. I have to pass, let's know your customer. I have to pass an anti-money laundering check. I have to make sure, I have to not be on the sanctions names list. So all like OFAC and all that stuff.
So these are attributes. These are policies
what
in order
I am.
For this to be valid.
Yes.
A valid transaction under whatever regulatory regime you're under. How do you do this without associating it with an identity? That might be a question for when we introduce what you're working on. I think this is a concept that's very foreign to a lot of people because we associate access to anything. Like literally I went to the airport and I showed them my ID. That's how I got here to talk to you. I go into a bar in order to prove that I'm 21 to get a drink. I show them my driver's license, which has like my address on it, my full name, all those things. It doesn't just have this person is of course over 21. It actually specifies when I was born, which is more information than they need. They just need to know I'm over 21.
And this is all the theory behind verifiable credentials, right? And on-creds and all that stuff. And the problem with this is that we have a fraud problem, right? People are able to fake things. And actually, it's not about, so we mentioned before we started recording about the analog to digital problem. So how do you translate that you're a bag of cells and water and I'm a bag of cells and water, but then when we're online, I'm this string of characters or this, you know, binary data that represents a public key or whatever. So how do you translate from, you know, molecules in the real world to something, you know, electrons on the internet? And right now what we do is we have a credential-based system. And it is fundamentally flawed in the fact that it does not take into account time. I have a driver's license. So, like, let's put it this way. I have it on good authority that the state of Utah issues digital driver's licenses. They're verifiable credentials. They're tied to your driver's license, but I think you can also put it in a wallet on your phone. I do not believe, and I could be wrong, but I have it on good authority that the digital part of your driver's license has no revocation mechanism. So I could go and do a DUI, have my driver's license yanked immediately, but the digital driver's license has no revocation system. And more importantly, it has no way of notifying everybody that it has been revoked.
Fascinating.
And so there is a...
I currently have some handle to you in my system that permits you to do something, assuming you have a valid driver's license, there's no way for me to get an update saying this condition is no longer true.
Right.
So my policy is going to be violated without me knowing.
Right. And to get back to my initial example of a financial transaction, the government updates the sanctioned slaves list without telling anybody. They just update the list and it's upon us to comply with it by checking it. We pull this list, P-O-L-L, we pull it. And so that's how people get updates. And there are commercial services that will do sanctioned name list checks and all this stuff. So you hit an API, they are pulling this list and they tell you yes or no, right? Well, if you issue a verifiable credential, do you know what a verifiable credential is?
I don't.
Okay. So a verifiable credential is really just some attestation, like this is true about this person, and it's digitally signed by the entity that issued it, the issuer, right? So think of it as like a digital driver's license. The issuer is the state of Utah, and what it says is, I am a licensed driver in the United States, but in the state of Utah. Right?
But unlike the driver's license, it sounds like the only thing that it contains is that this, I'm not sure if it even has an identity in it, but that the bearer of this, assuming they can prove that they're associated with it, is authorized to drive in the state of Utah.
Right.
It doesn't actually contain, like, well, my driver's license has my, you know, home address, my name, my birthday.
Right.
I guess what's the content, like, what is this inside of this?
So it could be things like, Mike Lauder is a brilliant cryptographer, and he wrote a lot of the non-cred stuff, which allows you to do zero knowledge proofs against a credential. And so you can do things like, I can give you a zero knowledge proof that this credential says I was born on a certain day. Therefore, I am over 21 and I can buy alcohol or something, right? The problem is not that part. That part is actually cool. The zero knowledge proof aspect, the bleeding edge of this, the leading edge of this is the functional real world part. That all works. The zero knowledge proof stuff is really cool. It's the fact that the credential itself exists. That credential is divorced from truth the second it is issued. Because if that credential said the bearer of this passes a sanctions names list, check, okay? And I have it on my phone in my wallet, okay? And they issued it to me, say yesterday, but 10 seconds after they issued it to me, the government put me on the sanctioned name list. Now, I have, you know, they have like time to live on them, just like certificate authority, TLS certificates. And so if I were to go and now do a financial transaction, I'm making a false assertion. I'm saying, yes, I am not on the sanctions names list, but I actually am at the time of the transaction, even though I have this credential. So the fact that we have a credential-based security system in this world is where almost all of the fraud comes from, because there is a window of exploitation in every credential, paper, you know, or digital, between the time it's issued and the time that you try to use it. The most systems now are really secure. They do real-time checks. They're like, I see your driver's license, but we're going to check with the DMV to see if it's still valid.
Mm.
And they do what's called late binding trust, which is at the point of execution, at the point of the transaction is when we go and validate whether your attestation is true.
At a bar, I go get a drink and they just look at my, you know, driver's license. But when I go to the counter to purchase a firearm, they go plug it into a database and validate that that driver's license is valid. And
yes, they do the FBI background check and all that stuff, okay. Depending on which state you're in, but yes. And they do a real time, that's called late binding trust, whereas credential issuance is early binding trust. Real time checks at the point of transaction execution is late binding trust. And all of the fraud in the world, I'm going on a limb on saying this, and I could be totally wrong, and I would love people to point out that I'm wrong. I feel like I don't get enough of that. I think people are afraid to say, hey, I think you're wrong about that. I'm giving everybody explicit permission right now. For me specifically, if you think I'm wrong, look me up. I'm very public. You can find me. Please tell me what I'm doing wrong because I want to get to the right answer. But the fact that we have early binding trust opens up both time and physical windows of exploitation, and we get a lot of fraud. What is getting to what I'm working on is moving to a system where what, not who, is proven at the point of transaction, and it is entirely, purely late binding trust because we can build zero knowledge based proof systems that are real time. So, like, to put it simply, if I wanted to execute a transaction of trading Bitcoins to UDC or USDC, when I go to authenticate with the API to post the sell order, it is challenging me saying, I have corporate and federal financial regulatory requirements to allow this transaction to happen. Here they are. Give me zero knowledge proofs. Yes, give me zero knowledge proofs that proves to me that you meet all of these policy things. And we can now do that in a fraction of a second. It works just like OAuth in the sense that you have like a third party.
Okay.
Right. And you can gather the zero knowledge proofs from all the proof providers and present it as proof against the policy. And that is your actual authentication. Now, nowhere in here did I say I'm Dave Huseby. What I said was I pass a KYC check from a vendor that you are advertising that you trust. And in fact, the policies, if they really wanted to be secure, they could say, we need to know that you've passed a KYC check from three different vendors that we all trust and that those vendors all agree. This is
I imagine that that system doesn't exist in the world today. It's infeasible.
It is not infeasible and it does exist and it's currently in my lab.
Okay. So this is a good time. You are CEO and a co-founder of Cryptid Tech where you are building some pretty wickedly cool stuff.
Yeah. So
what do you have cooking in the lab?
Well, let me finish.
Sorry, I'm cutting you off. Yes.
We'll talk about the lab, but the coolest thing here is that the security model then becomes what we call a corroboration-based security system. It's not enough to just pass a KYC and get a verifiable credential, because that can be exploited. But when I go to do that transaction, if it is a highly regulated transaction, say like over $10,000, right? Something that could be legitimate money laundering, right? And they're like, oh, you know, every check in the book has to pass for this to even be compliant. They could demand that I have to provide proof from multiple sources. And if you know anything about statistics, the likelihood that I could cheat 12 different sources of a KYC, you know, is much less than my ability to lie, to generate a synthetic ID and fool a KYC vendor. There's a single one. So the idea is...
That seems intuitively true to me.
It is intuitively true, but we do not do this. This is not part of our security models literally anywhere. Even if you were to join Coinbase or whatever, they just do a single KYC vendor.
And like with the credit bureaus, there's generally one they query. They don't query all three to validate that you're trustworthy.
Yeah.
Do you feel like part of this is just the cost of implementation versus the value of minimizing fraud?
I think it's the real-time, late-binding trust, zero-knowledge proof network does not exist. And the reason it doesn't...
A foundational load-bearing building block.
Right. Credit cards didn't work until Visa Network existed.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there needs to be a network that allows relying parties, the APIs and whatever, to challenge, here are our policies. And then that needs to work behind the scenes automatically, like OAuth does, to go and gather the zero knowledge proofs for the principal, the client, and present them all automatically behind the scenes. Again, this would be a transparent upgrade of our existing authentication system because it's like, it works like OAuth
in the sense that it goes transparent upgrade.
Like it wouldn't change. Like I might have to do a couple things in the real world to set up my relationship with this platform. But once I'm set up, then it works just like every other system. In fact, it's probably smoother because I might just have to present a biometric or like a hardware token of some kind plus a biometric or whatever to bind myself to the device that is issuing the request, which then allows me to coordinate the gathering of the zero knowledge proofs as my authentication system, right? And you need to do things like build a data fiduciary. There needs to be an entity that is legally bound to represent the client themselves, the person, because you need something that knows everything about you, but is barred through ethics and laws and legal contracts from ever selling or sharing that information. But they need to know it so that they can go to, like, they need to know a way to tell a credit rating agency, hey, I need a zero knowledge proof for this one human being, right? They need to be the coordinator of all this. It's kind of like a matchmaking service, but it's for authenticity or authentication. And so anyway, I could talk about this forever.
No, I want you to talk about this forever. but we have these six, they sound like load-bearing philosophical principles for building truly decentralized systems where users maintain their sovereignty. It sounds like every existing system we have on the internet, and maybe the internet itself, violates these principles in one way or another.
Email's pretty damn close.
Pretty close.
As not violating any of these. Depends on who your email provider is. I would say if you're using ProtonMail, they do a bunch of stuff to willfully blind themselves to information about their clients on purpose.
Fascinating.
On purpose. That's part of the raison d'etre of
this reason.
I do not actually. I run my own email service because you don't have to ask for permission. You can run your own email servers. And so I just take
but
that
you do
question.
Have to ask the other email servers for permission to deliver email. This is
Nope. There's a standard for that. It's DKIM.
Okay.
So you can assert the control over a domain and yeah, I guess your deliverability might be hampered, but I've never seen this. I'm not mass mailing though. I'm just emailing community people, you know, and participating in open source projects, and I've never had deliverability issues. And you basically are you're advertising your TLS certificate public key, the one tied to your domain. So like if I own like crypted.tech and we have a TLS certificate, I can advertise the public key from the certificate in the DNS records, in the DNS server itself for the domain. And then whenever an email comes in, I think email servers go and
query the record, mm-hmm. verify.
Because you use a TLS connection to deliver the mail. And then the way they validate the certificate presented on the TLS, the way they do mutual TLS authentication is that they take the public key, they go look it up in the DNS record, and if it matches, I think that's what it does. I'm not an expert on DKIM, but I know that if I put my public key in the DNS server, then all my emails magically work. I don't know. I'm the best worst systems operator or the worst best. I don't know.
So we have email that comes very close to checking the boxes for you.
Yeah, I think it's the most decentralized system on the internet today.
You're working on a handful of systems that I feel like you're asserting help meaningfully move the needle for the rest of the internet as well. I think you've spoken to it a handful of times already, this load-bearing idea of the zero-knowledge proofs and how they relate to identity. It's what you have baking in the lab. I'm really interested. Yeah, what are you working on? Why do you think it's going to meaningfully change things?
Well, I'll tell you the thing I have the most faith in that, you know, might be a total flop. Actually, it might not work at all. Seems to work for me. And I'm in the process of open sourcing it right now and documenting the standards. So I do not believe in standards bodies insofar as design by committee. I think we should burn them all down. I liked the original idea of RFCs where people would build systems, get them into the market. If they prove useful, then we would open it up. That's why we use the term open source, open systems, is because everything was closed. And then once in a while, a system got opened up and that became an open system. And, you know, and that just is how that became a colloquialism. And when they opened the system, the way of opening it was to document the protocol or document the file system, the file formats or whatever, right? And the RFC system was originally this way. And that's why a lot of the original RFCs are still in use today, but a lot of RFCs written today are never used, you know? Like, I was picking on verifiable credentials earlier, and, you know, DID documents are tied to this, and DIDs themselves and stuff. Despite having been around for 10 years and being standardized for 5, there is no wide deployment of any of these standards from W3C. Sure, there's little demos here and there, and there are some Web3 companies that are using DIDs, and, you know, Blue Sky is probably the biggest one that uses DIDs. I think they're totally redundant and stupid, but this just shows that, like, design by committee is fraught with peril. I think you should build a system, prove it works.
The capture.
Yes, I think you build a system, prove it works, and then you do the rest of the world a favor by documenting it and opening it up. But I think that designing by committee is easily captured by people who put themselves into places of power to defend their own personal pocketbooks.
The power-seeking actors look at that as a point of...
Yeah.
Point
this, this is why I'm allergic to, like, the W3C and the IETF, why I can't go to these meetings, because it really is just a bunch of either people paid by corporations to throw sand in the works, you know, they throw sand in the gears to move it one way or the other or prevent it from happening, or it's people who come there who have their own pet ego that they're trying to defend, and they just sit and scream and yell at everybody like, no, we need to use this one encoding. It's like, it's an encoding. It can be any encoding. Why don't you design it so that the encoding is self-describing, and then we can use any encoding, and you can have your encoding and I can have, no, it must be my encoding. It's like, okay, idiot, you're not serious. You're not being a serious player here. Like, abstraction is the way we all get along. And I'm just tired of getting into just endless debate about it. At least in our political systems, you have cloture votes where everybody can be like, okay, we're done arguing. We vote to shut the hell up and vote on this, right? We don't have cloture. There's no notion of cloture in standards bodies.
So, I actually didn't know this existed until now. I have something I need to go look up. You said it's cloture.
Yeah. So, like, in Congress, and they debate something, they could be endlessly arguing forever, but there's a point where someone can call for a cloture vote, which says, okay, everybody's going to shut up and we're going to put it to a vote. Okay. Debate is over. You've heard everybody. You keep going back and forth. Now everybody's tired of listening to you two people yell at each other. We, the rest of us here in Congress, vote for you two to shut up so that we can all vote.
Okay.
Right. This doesn't exist in any of our standards bodies.
Mm.
And it needs to exist. But I mean, if we can't burn them down, we should at least imply or, you know, put some procedures in place to, like, end the endless debate.
Well, it sounds like sense. You're not burning them down, but you're building around. You're working on
I'm building something right that I think will work, and I'm going
to
document it.
You're not asking permission to
I'm not
you're
asking
building
permission.
It, you're going to document it.
Yeah. So what I've been building that I'm really excited about, and I've talked about this with Doc Searles on his podcast and stuff, is, you know, I've been talking about provenance based authenticity forever.
Can you define that?
So
provenance based authenticity.
So the authenticity piece is, how do you know where this data came from? You know, what the data says, this is not about that the data says something is true or not. What we're looking at is, where did this data come from? Who, it's the chain of custody. Think of data as like evidence from a crime scene. We should all think of data like this, because we all look at data and then we make real world decisions based on this. That person said this thing about that other person. I hate them now. I'm making like a strong emotional decision about somebody, but how do I know that that tweet or that was actually them, first of all, and that it wasn't manipulated for me, right? Like, there's this terrifying idea that if someone could get on my router and could somehow man in the middle all of my communications, they could paint a picture to me that is a completely false reality. They could filter any text messages and tweets and everything coming to me and change the words and all this other stuff to try to make it so that I have a completely false impression of how the world really is. And so when you're going to make real world decisions, whether they're emotional or physical or financial or whatever, based off of things you see on the internet, I would caution you against that, because we now know that AI can fake literally anything.
I was about to ask this. How does your idea of provenance and authenticity, you've talked about the authentic data economy.
Yeah.
I feel like that is becoming hyper-relevant at a very interesting speed.
Right. So because we can fake any data, you shouldn't make any operational decisions over any data unless you can cryptographically verify this data came from here, it was modified here, or not. Here's the chain of custody of how the data got from where it was created to you. And this directly applies to artificial intelligence, because if you combine corroboration-based security, you can do things like, for me to be able to assert my intellectual property rights over data and be paid, like have a copyright and enforce my intellectual property rights, I would have to, like as a corporation or as an individual, identify myself, have that corroborated, and then I'm the one who claims that I'm the creator of this data. Now, you could argue that that can be faked, right? Like I could go and take a photo you took and I can claim it.
Right.
But this has always been true in this company or in this country around patents and other intellectual property. And we have a legal system and a court system that can adjudicate this. And our rule is whoever's comes first owns it. So, I mean,
so the reason why solve this part of the system,
we don't have to solve this
because we have proof of bullets that has worked for the entirety of
society.
Where correct. We have governing bodies whose sole job is to settle these disagreements.
Correct. You know, like the reason why we say Edison and the reason we say Edison invented the light bulb, there were like dozens of scientists working on an incandescent bulb at the same time. But Edison found the right filament material first and rushed to the patent office and filed his patent first. And that's why Edison Electric existed and not, you know, some other person's electric company, because they got it, even though it wasn't, you know, it's how the internet works now. Like everybody has similar ideas. And we go to these conferences and someone's like, I have this really great idea. I think I'm the first one. And everybody's like, no, we talked about it over here and all this other stuff. Okay, great. That was the same for like light bulbs and electricity and all these other things. But there was an inventor, the first person to actually engage with our legal governmental system around intellectual property first. Okay. So what we need to do is build a verifiable attestation that ties a piece of data to something I control, like a key pair or something that is tied to my identity, so that I can glue the legal intellectual property system to specific data, so that I can positively assert my ownership over some data I created. And it needs to be transparent and as lightweight as possible. It needs to be a transparent upgrade of the way we work. Like, one of the things we play around with at Cryptid is a verifiable email. Like, did this email actually come from who you think it came from? And we use these, every piece of data has its own little provenance log, which is a, you can think of it as like a, it's a series of log entries, obviously. And each one, it's a hash chain, it's a hash linked data structure. So it's like an IPLD thing. It can be uploaded to IPFS and you can look things up based on their content addresses and everything. So like each one is linked to the previous
only hash log.
Yeah. It's an append only hash log. But controlling who can and cannot write the next entry in this log is where the innovation comes in. So you need to have something very similar to like Bitcoin scripts, right? Lock and unlock scripts. You need to say that the current head of this log, the current most recent entry in this log, has a set of rules that determine what makes the next entry valid. Does that, do you
it
follow?
Does. Yes. So,
so you can say something like the next entry must be signed.
Yeah. What is the next valid block? And generally there's a consensus, but the consensus model for like Bitcoin is external to the chain.
Yeah, but you don't need a consensus here because these are identity related transactions, which are either first party or third party. You only need distributed consensus when you have two party transactions.
Say distributed. Sorry, that might be, I use consensus a little differently than some.
Sure.
So consensus of this is, in fact, we all agree that this chain is in this state.
Yes.
Which would be like, in this model, it seems like, do you have proof of signature?
Right. You could like a super simple one would be the next entry is comes with a digital signature that validates with this public key. So you're making a cryptographic commitment to a digital signature of a specific key, right? Mm-hmm. That's just standard, like, okay, the next thing's going to be digitally signed with this key.
But you have a broader rule set that can be encoded into this block to define what the next valid block is.
Yeah. So what we did that I think is novel is, and this seems probably very obvious to everybody, we built our own WASM VM. So we take WASM, right? WASM time, and we have a set of functions that are exposed to these scripts like check signature and all that other stuff. Okay. That's not innovative. That's not very interesting. What is interesting is that the lock scripts themselves, so when you have a proposed new entry, that contains an unlock script, which sets up a virtual stack. This is very similar to how Bitcoin works, right? It's like push the data, push the pub key, and then the lock script runs, and the lock script says like check sig, right? Which assumes that there's going to be the data and the signature, the signature and the key on the stack, right? However, when you're talking about a non-blockchain, non-distributed consensus system, you have a potential where if someone steals my keys, then they get to create the next block or next log entry, and they can rotate to their keys and they can just steal my provenance log. They can take control over it. How do you fix that? And what we came up with was to add precedence to checks. So as a script executes, a lock script executes, it's going to execute some arbitrary logic, like check this and check this or check this. Okay. But what we did was every time a check function is called, there's an internal counter that increments. And so therefore, if you have two competing entries for the next slot, like there's two log entries, or maybe even back in the history, I go back and I create a log entry that competes with an existing one. Okay. The protocol is not like Bitcoin. It's not to follow the longest chain. The protocol is to, of all of the competing entries, the one with the lowest check score takes precedence. So that means that it required the fewest number of check function calls to validate. So for instance, here's the perfect, like this is the simplest possible example. Okay. If you had a lock script that says, if check pub key signature, or check pre-image password. Okay. So it's like the next thing, the next entry in the log is valid if it's signed or it has the pre-image that hashes to this value. So it's like a password. So it can either be digitally signed.
So I could recover the log even if I've lost the key kind of thing.
You could use a password, right? But because the check counter increments for every one of those checks, if you produced one that was a password, okay, its check scores too, because we checked the public key signature first, that failed. So it goes up by one. So now then it checks the password and then it goes up. So the final score is 2. Now, if I were to later go, oh crap, there's my keys. I had a backup somewhere. Now I could go and make a competing entry that is digitally signed that rotates, whatever I'm doing with it, and publish it. And now the protocol, the understanding is that whichever one has the lowest check score is the valid one. So I can go back and do this digitally signed one and it will actually functionally replace the password one because its check score is only 1.
Fascinating.
Okay. Now let me blow your mind.
Okay.
Okay. So this allows you to build arbitrary sets of rules around who and what can create the next entry. One of the things that we've discovered is that if we use threshold signing, do you know what threshold signing is? Okay, so threshold signing is public key signatures that use pairing-based algorithms, so like BLS 12381. This allows you to do what's called key splitting. So I can generate a public-private key pair, and I can split the private key in such a way using Shamir secret sharing so that I can say, okay, I have this private key. I'm going to break it into 5 pieces and I want to do it in such a way that any 3 of those can be used to reconstitute the key.
So you create a Horcrux for your provenance log.
That's exactly what this is. Right, okay. On. But because we're using pairing curves, I can hand the private key share to you and to all of my friends, my closest friends, my relatives, whatever. And when I send you a message that contains my next event that I want to, like, let's say I lost my laptop and I've lost my keys and I can't remember my freaking password. And the top check is a threshold signature check. And then the second one is a public key check. And the third one is a password check. So the way for me to force rotate back, like if someone stole my keys, I could force rotate back and take over control again. Or if I lost a laptop or whatever, I can use a threshold signature because it has the highest precedence to force control back to me.
So if you lose your keys, you can go to people you've trusted to help you reconstitute.
Yes. Full social recovery. And using threshold signing with BLS 12381, you have just a share of the private key. So I send you this event, this new event for my log to get your signature. You sign it with the private share. And what comes back is a signature share. Okay. Now, you don't have to cooperate or you don't have to collaborate with anybody else for this to happen. You don't have to meet with my other friends to reconstitute the key and then collectively sign it. You just give me your signature share. And then my mom gives me her signature share and my business partner gives me their signature share. Okay. I take the signature shares, and because of the way the math works, I can reconstitute the signature from 3 of 5 signature shares. So this, what's also, cool this is
like
it doesn't
work. This is like a board being able to
100%.
Override. That's awesome.
Yes. You could do total corporate governance this way. And the interesting part here is that you don't have to have like a key signing party. You don't have to be physically present or you don't have to share your shares with each other to reconstitute the key to generate a signature. You just make your signature share and send it back. And if we're using proper encryption, there's no middle man in the middle, then this is an entirely secure process. And I can send out requests to my threshold group without having access to my prior keys, without having access to my passwords or anything like that, right? I can just say, hey, here's a message, right? You'd probably want to call me on the phone and be like, did you send this to me, right? And I'd be like, yeah, sure, sign it, right?
We have a pre-established safe word for...
Yeah, something like that. I mean, you know, there's going to have to be some kind of corroboration, right? That it's legit. And we can do all kinds of stuff. These are side channels. I had a really interesting discussion with somebody yesterday on the Slack channel, the Slack chat for LibP2P about this. But yeah, what it does is it allows you guys don't have to collaborate. Like, you don't need to know my mom to help me recover my account. You just send me your share. She sends me her share. I reconstitute it. I publish it. Okay. That is how I can force rotate. But more importantly, and I'm going to get to one other little feature that we'd like about these provenance logs is that they essentially, each entry has a list of operations on a key value pair store. So it's either updates or deletes. Okay. And so as you process it, what you're doing is building up a key value pair store. It's a virtual one because you have to process the whole log to get the whole thing. But an update on a key that doesn't exist is an insert or a create, right? So we just have those two. And we can scope, because we have arbitrary logic in the lock scripts, we can say things like, if the next entry is signed by this one key, or assigned by the latest key in this other provenance log, and it only changes this one key in the key values. I know we're term overloading. I hate this. But like, if it's updating this one part of the storage of the provenance log, then it's valid. So I can scope. I could grant to you the ability to create events that go into my provenance log. I can delegate access. Yes, exactly. So this would allow me to say, like, I have a paid relationship with a KYC vendor, and they, from time to time, will change their APIs as they upgrade. They don't need to coordinate with me. All they need to do is, I've already delegated to them that the endpoint for my KYC zero knowledge proof is stored under, you know, Dave's endpoint, Dave's KYC endpoint. That's the key. And the value of that is a URL to a KYC vendor that I have a relationship with. Okay. If they change their API because they've upgraded their system, all they have to do, because I've delegated to them, is publish a new event on my provenance log that updates that value.
This inverts the relationship between you and your vendors online, where today, in order for me to have a relationship with you, I have to give you root access to whatever identity I'm giving you like they'll have yeah. management.
Or but I can delegate access.
Now you can delegate access to your data.
Yes. And this is also built into the authentication system that we also built. So it's like part of your relationship is, yeah, I'm going to delegate access because we all want to pay for services. Like I want to pay companies to vouch for me. I want to be my own like little network of zero knowledge proof generators that prove that I have Bitcoins or that I pass a KYC vendor or check or whatever, right? But they need to be free to do their own business and they need to be able to update endpoints and they need to be able to update the things that would normally break the links in this distributed system. But by doing delegation using this novel approach to lock and unlock scripts and the key value, the virtual key value pair store that builds up over a provenance log, I can delegate like, oh, I'm going to pay you so much each month. Feel free to update the endpoint as you update it. Just publish these things so that my provenance log always has your latest endpoint.
Fascinating.
And I can build in rules like, you know, if you're going to do that, you have to ask me first. So you have to send it to me. It has to be a 2 of 2 threshold signature. So you can sign it yourself with your share, send it to me and I'll review it. And then I'll sign it. I'll do a signature with my share and constitute the signature and then publish it. So I can enforce my own consent over your changes. Or if I'm comfortable with you just updating, you know, your endpoints and updating my provenance log, I just delegate it to you.
That's awesome, man.
So he gives you like full, like, this is what self-sovereignty is. Do I care? Do I not care? If I care, then I'm the one who decides. If I don't care, I can delegate to you and I can pay you money and you just do it for me. So where are we going with all this? First of all, the provenance log stuff is going to be open source, like source available. I'm publishing all the standards. So I fully expect there to be other implementations and I fully encourage it. I'm just documenting what we build and what works. I have built a new signing tool called BetterSign. I chose that name because I have a sick sense of humor. I'm hoping that everybody starts calling them BS signatures.
I think that would be
really funny. Like, well, is there a BS signature on it? Yeah.
We're going to make this happen.
Yeah. So anyway, BetterSign is a signing tool designed to replace GPG. And it uses provenance logs to track the key histories of all of your identities. So key rotations do not, and key compromise and loss do not break. The idea here is we're going to build a system that creates long-lived identifiers for your identity that for these provenance logs, right? Because you can think of your identity as actually the accumulation of all your interactions with a system over time, okay? And I could unpack that over like an hour, but I don't have time to right now. But if you can just assume that that's what your identity actually is, it's not your name, it's not your public key. It is actually a cryptographically verifiable record of your interactions and the relevant metadata that govern your interactions, your relationship between you and a system. And I say a system because you're likely to have a provenance log for every relationship between you and every server or even every sys service or like even every API endpoint. You may even have one. And we do that. We create provenance logs for every piece of data too, so that you can have like a chain of custody on every, like this photograph and stuff. And one thing that Cryptid does is they do NIL, name, image, and likeness management. It's the business they're actually in. And with these provenance logs, we're doing basically NFTs without a cryptocurrency, without a blockchain, because you don't need distributed consensus over this. And I could tell you the story about how I liberated an NFT from OpenSea and now I manage it privately with a provenance log. So I have the world's first piece of private digital art now that's cryptographically verifiable, provable. Like I burned the token.
That's a radical statement.
So I burned the token in OpenSea because you can gift, right? So I burned it to an address, which is actually the identifier for the provenance log that has the hash and the location, the canonical location, and is tied to my identity as the owner and has the identifier of the records on OpenSea.
You've taken the intellectual property off chain.
Yep. So there's a two-way link between my private provenance log and what's on chain. And I have the right under there, at least when I bought it. I don't know if their terms have changed, but I was able to take the high resolution copy and I technically own it. And what they were expecting is everybody would use their system to verify if I'm the owner or not, but I don't need that. I just burn the token to the identifier for the provenance log. I have a copy locally. The provenance log now manages the entire chain of custody, right? Including pointers back to the records at OpenSea when I bought it and it was transferred to me. So now I have probably the world's only piece of private, verifiable digital art. I have the first NFT that doesn't have a cryptocurrency tied to it. And we don't have to go on chain. So I could sell it to you right now under any terms that you and I agree to.
This is fascinating.
Yeah. So
this is the way things are supposed to work. Supposed this is how to work. They work in the real world.
Yeah. Private commerce. Yeah. So anyway, here's what we're doing. I have a signing tool, BetterSign. You create identities, it creates a provenance log. The provenance logs are your key history. Okay. There's addresses that identify these provenance logs that I call VLADs. They're very long addresses. And the important thing here is that they are not derived from key material. They are supposed to be stable over a very long period of time. And one of the things we didn't touch on before is I actually think the reason the main reason that there is the web is not just the standards, but because URLs themselves have a piece of them that are very long lived, the domain name. Okay. So like you could have a really long URL going to some random thing on Amazon and it doesn't work. The Amazon's like, oops, we don't know what that is. So you just delete the pathing part and Amazon.com still works. You're still on Amazon and now you have, so your relationship, that link between you and Amazon is long lived and stable. Can you imagine how the web would work if domain names changed all the time?
If you had dynamic IP addresses, but for domain names, right?
Yeah, like if it was Amazon.com this week, but then it was Amazon with a zero next week, and then it was for Amazon the week after that, right? We would think that's absolutely ridiculous. Like, that doesn't work. Except that's what we accept in PKI, in GPG. People rotate their keys all the time, and then it's like, oh, we got to do key signing, you know, ceremonies and verify that it really is you. And it's like, no, that's horseshit. Nobody does that. Right? That's not how the world works. And yet that's what very serious people with straight faces said, we're going to build a global web of trust based off of identifiers that change all the damn time. Okay. I don't see how that works. And the only way you can, and people think this is true because it's like, oh yeah, private, you know, key pairs need to rotate all the time and you lose them. And so that's just how it has to work. No, it isn't. Right? You need something that is an arbitrary identifier that can link resources or people to services or whatever, just links identifiers that are stable over long periods of time. And I think one of the secrets of the web is the fact that the domain part of URLs are very stable.
Stable enough.
Yes. And I think that's why we say the web, but there is not the web of trust.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. There hasn't been a web of trust that kind of congealed out of nothing spontaneously. And I think it's because the links change all the time.
There was our credit bureaus and governments and everybody would use it, but
right.
We don't.
Right. We don't even use it as developers. I mean,
that's Linux true. Kernel, unless it's an org policy, I don't.
Right. And we know better.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that just from this mental exercise, I think, and again, I could be totally wrong, and please tell me I'm an idiot if I am. But I think what this tells us is that there is some threshold. Like if you have a graph and what you're graphing is the lifespan of the identifier, how long do they live on average? A URL, at least the domain part, is on the order of years. Key pairs, on the order of weeks, maybe months. So the key pairs being identifiers in the web of trust don't work because they change too often, but the domain part of a URL being stable over years works, and we have the web. So there is a threshold somewhere in between where if the identifiers live long enough, you get a network that congeals. Okay. If you know anything about like system stability design and feedback loops and all this stuff, there are sets of initial conditions where, a system will fly apart. And then there are sets of initial conditions where a system becomes resilient or anti-fragile, like in a Taleban sense, that if you like cut a part of it off or you impact that system in some way, it's stable. It's a self-dampening system. It comes back to stability. Okay. It's like you can lop your arm off and as long as you stop the bleeding, you're going to live, right? Because your body is anti-fragile. It is a stable system that will come back to an equilibrium point, a stable point, so long as you don't bleed out, right? But bleeding out is a set of initial, like is one of the initial conditions of your system. The fact that you can bleed out shows that there are some conditions which will make your system fly apart or die in this case, right? It stops working. So
we want to build these anti-fragile systems into our identity system.
You need to have identifiers that live long enough, or at least have a part that lives long enough. And Vlads are designed to be this. They are not derived from key material. They have the same properties as public keys, meaning that there is a random part that is enough entropy that we can use it to assign a number to every molecule in the universe. That's part of the reason why we use public keys, right? But then the other thing, reason we use public keys is they're a cryptographic commitment to a verification function. So we can tie control between a process or a person and a piece of data, right? I can prove I can sign it. Therefore, there is some like operational control. So Vlads are basically a nonce and the CID for a WASM script that runs in this VM that we're using for provenance logs. And so it is a long-lived address. You know, it's a concatenation of these two things. So it is a random piece and the CID of the validation function,
which gives you continuity of your keys.
Right. And that always identifies your provenance log. Okay. And it's designed to be stable over the lifespan of the provenance log.
So if you can find the log, you can find the keys that are currently controlled, even if they've been rotated, you can...
The log itself has the entire history of keys for that one log, like all your rotations and everything. Okay. And another thing that I'm shocked that isn't obvious to everybody is that in a world where we're supposedly digitally signing everything, which we are now, like a lot of stuff is being digitally signed, there is going to be old data signed with old keys. And therefore you have to have a way to link old keys with your current keys in a cryptographically verifiable way, or else why are we signing anything?
Right.
Because a second that key disappears, gets deleted, gets rotated, compromised, whatever, not only can we not signal to everybody that that key was compromised, and therefore it's been re-signed.
It's not revocable.
Yeah. And so, yes, exactly. And anyway, how would you know how to the public key and how to verify it if you don't have access to the old keys? So you need a cryptographic log of all of your key history, right? And then you need an address, an identifier for that log that is not key material, that is going to be stable over time. I want it to be like the domain part of a URL. I can give it to you and it will always be available. You will always be able to find it. And if we use something like IPFS, right? I can run my own IPFS servers. I can pay somebody to pin my data, my provenance log. And one of the other cool things on IPFS is we can map public keys to CIDs using IPNS. So here's how we do this. Provenance logs, every event has the Vlad in it. So if you get any event in the log, you have the Vlad that allows you to look up the head of the log and get the whole log. Okay. In the events where you rotate to a new public key pair, a new key pair, and you're publishing the public key, you also create an IPNS record and you maintain these. So now if you were to find one of my public keys in the wild, say assigned,
you can get back to the,
you look up, you take that public key, you use IPNS to find the log entry in which it became my current, my public key, but that might not be my current public key. It was in my history, but it has the Vlad in that entry, which allows me to get to the front. And now I have my whole key history. So you can find any public key in the wild and get the whole key history from me. And not only is my key history in that log, but also things like my endpoints. Like, hey, you want to send, want to find me on Telegram? Here's my handle, t.me/whatever. That's in there too. So now you find
so you can bridge identities across multiple
systems. Every public key you find out there translates into a provenance log and endpoints. So you're like, holy crap, who was it that signed this? Let's see if they're still active. And you go find the provenance log. Then you go find the most recent endpoints, like what's their Telegram handle or their email address, whatever. And you just send them a message. That's from a public key in a signed commit in a random repo on a random server somewhere. You can map that back to. So this solves distributed discovery, like being able to
find, if you,
you can't search, but if you can find the public key, you can get to their key history and you can get to their, the other metadata.
Or if you have any of their content, you can get back to their key and you have an addressable human or pseudonymous human. You have addressable content and you have addressable devices, which I'm assuming are the devices in control of the key pair.
Yes.
So you've made a fully addressable internet of people and things.
Yes. And so what BetterSign is it's designed to replace GPG in the context of Git repos themselves. Now, Git repos are hash-linked data structures. So we can store the provenance logs in the Git repo itself. Okay. So that's the first bit of information. The second bit of information is you can then, so I have a Git repo, a test repo that I'm working on right now that says for you to contribute, so I use Git hooks and all this stuff. It only accepts commits that are digitally signed by a public key that is the most recent public key in any of the provenance logs that are in the repo itself. So for you to be able to contribute to a repo, the first thing you have to do is send a patch or a pull request that has your provenance log in it. So it adds your provenance log to the repo. And your first event, you know, because I have like rules around this. Remember, we were talking about you know, your policies. So the policy for my repo, this test repo, is that the provenance log, the first event of the provenance log has to have a digital signature over the contributor agreement, over the software license, so like APL or whatever, and over the code of conduct. And the lock script itself has a threshold signature as the top check, the highest precedent, but the threshold is the maintainer's.
So these BS signatures are true digital signatures, much like DocuSign, allowing you to agree to terms of services, agree to community conduct, et cetera, with full provenance.
Right. And you're also delegating, to a threshold, you know, like a simple majority threshold signature of the maintainers, delegating them the right to maintain your pub key in your key value pair store. So they, you're delegating to the maintainers of the project the ability to create the next entry in your log to either rotate to a new key pair for you so they can recover your account, or they can rotate your key to null and they can kick you out.
So do you see what you just pitched is very engineering focused and very technical. Do you see a way of communicating this to non-technical users? Is that a path forward for you? Are you focused on
So this is
right now, or?
Well, it's, So I've been giving sneak peeks to some really cool engineers that I respect and getting their feedback and trying to incorporate it before the full launch. But the way I usually communicate to people is if you change your repos to be managed in this way, you get full IAM capabilities enforced in cryptography, including all of your corporate policies around your software development process. And what Cryptid sells are the enterprise tooling that glues enterprise policy management into the provenance logs and the rule sets and everything that need to be in place in the provenance logs so that you can use cryptographic techniques to enforce those policies literally in the repo themselves.
Upgrade. You sell the transparent upgrade.
Yeah. 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 So you just sign up with us and you enroll all the contributors in your repo. You can upgrade existing repos, again, transparently. But if you're starting new repos, like as people join, like they just use a, you know, there's porcelain commands, git join, you know, and the repo URL or, the, you know, the path to the repo locally. And it will generate a provenance log and a commit and it'll walk you through like, hey, do you sign this? This is licensed by this. This is, here's the code of conduct. Do you agree to agree? And you're like, yes, 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 yes. And then it generates the provenance log with your digital signatures of with your new key pair and submits it. And that's you joining. And the cool thing here is that with this, none of this requires a server. Did I mention that? There is no centralization. As long as I can move messages between you and me, this works. So I can either email these to you, like we can email patches. I can also email messages saying like, hey, will you work with me? Like if we're two maintainers and I lost my key pair and we have a one of two threshold as maintainers to rotate, to change my pub key advertisement in my provenance log, I lose my key pair. I can be like, hey, William, will you sign this? It's my new key pair. And then you sign it.
You can recover the identity.
And I can recover
have to go through GitHub to get that done.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right.
So this is still a little, like, we're still technically leaning here. I see what you've built applying to rethinking the way that society approaches even, like, well, what used to be social networking is now social media. But I see this empowering a whole new class of product. Like this strikes me as market making, where an entire new class of business is going to exist that couldn't exist before you brought this. How do we reach, like, what you just described is something like a CTO and a, like, I think that resonates with them. Do you see this ever being packaged in a way that, let's say, my grandmother understands?
That's the transparent upgrade. Like, that's the transparent, I don't think, upgrade. Your grandma needs to understand. Right. I think she just uses the internet.
So so this will be handled behind the scenes by all of her existing vendors. And
that's what the delegation part is. That's why it's so critical.
So there's, So that's the path to 8 billion users is start with.
Well, no, the path to 8 billion users is you build a really cool development tool that allows developers to actually have proper governance over their repos and solve any of the legal headaches that come around, you know, open source projects that get big and used. Like, for you to, for, let's say you create an open source project and, like, Amazon says, hey, I want to use this in our, you know, in our infrastructure, we're going to make billions of dollars using this. There's actually quite a burden on that open source project to get their, for lack of a better term, their shit together. You have to have contributor agreements in place. You have to have licensing in place. You have to have all that stuff. You have to have the provenance on the software development process, or else you're disqualifying yourself for corporate adoption or, like, customer adoption, right? This is part of what Linux Foundation does. This is their real value, is they're very good at paperwork. I love the Linux Foundation because they kind of forced open source to grow up. They made some very controversial, maybe in the beginning, not so much anymore, but, like, opinions. They came out with some opinions. No, we're going to use these licenses. That's where you get, like, the OSI or whatever, you know, the open source initiative, like, saying, yes, we bless these licenses. The creation of Creative Commons, the creation of CLAs, you know, contributor licensing agreements, and all this other stuff. They put all of the framework in place, the legal frameworks in which open source can be developed and deployed in industry. And it's all done under, like, normalized legal business, right? They forced us all to grow up. Now, what I'm trying to do is build a tool that automates that without requiring a server, without requiring, you know, asking for permission. This just has same defaults. And by doing this, what you're getting is when people start contributing, before they can contribute, they have to sign your legal agreements. They have to be part of it. You can even set up policies that say you have to be KYC'd before you can join. I have to know who you really are. This is mostly important for things like classified software projects or software projects that are being used in clandestine services where they require to know who put what where. You know, it's not some random hacker from Oklahoma, because we know all the hackers in Oklahoma are, like, secretly undermining the government. you know, they can filter to adopt software that has known contributors, right? So you need this ability to set these arbitrary policies. Now, most open source projects would be like, I don't need to know who you are, just prove you're human, right? Because AI can write code now. And AI, I'm waiting for the article of, like, that backdoor in the Linux kernel was written, submitted, argued over, and landed entirely by an AI. That is going to happen. And so
it's not an if, it's a win.
Yeah, that is 100% going to happen. And so this is pushing back, like, these provenance logs and these systems we're building off of it are pushing back, because we're positively asserting that this, I am a human. I can prove to you I'm human. I have multiple KYC vendors that all agree I'm a human and that I did create this. And there's a number of things you can do with this. And I'll wrap this up. This is sort of like the coup de grace here. To get it back to AI, because you mentioned it earlier. With provenance logs, you can track all of the intellectual property rights around data being used to train AI. You can then also track the models themselves in their own provenance logs. So you know, like, the provenance log, so this version of this model, this log has links to every provenance log for every piece of data that was fed into it. And then you can create a forked provenance log. So it has fork, meaning it has a reference back to the AI's provenance log for everything the AI creates. So now you have full intellectual property management and transparency training with training data, the model itself and everything it creates.
In a way that would hold up in court when somebody...
Yes. And so this is like name, image, likeness management. This is kind of what Cryptid does as our main product. But like this would have set us up with the ability to say, I have this huge corpus of data that I own. I'm going to rent it basically to AI companies who want to use that data to train. And I'm not going to charge up front. What I'm going to do is say anything that's downstream that makes money, I get a split of. So that's one of the consequences. So we can actually say now we're setting up the environment where we can legitimately, so this is the last point I want to get to, which is right now the world is an allow list. Wait, the world is a block list, sorry, where we allow everything and then we play whack-a-mole to block data, right? That's either, you know, pirated stuff on social media, whatever, right? So we allow all data and then we retroactively go back and try to block data that doesn't meet the rules or whatever of whatever system it's in. Okay. So that's the world today. But with these provenance logs being so trivially simple and so transparently it's a transparent upgrade and their applicability in basically everything, tracking the provenance of all data, we can now assert our intellectual property rights and force platforms to switch from a block list model where they block retroactively to an allow list model, which is I only allow things on my platform that have provable provenance, and there's corporate policy in here, provable provenance back to a human. How do I know they're human? Multiple KYC vendors agree. And that is verified at the point of submission through a real-time late binding zero knowledge proof system.
That's amazing.
So what we're getting at now is if this becomes widely deployable or widely deployed and adopted, it will be normal for people to say, if this doesn't have provable provenance, it's AI, it's generated, it's fake. You could just assume that.
Yeah, or I don't trust it at the very least. Yeah,
right, I'm not gonna let it on my system. I don't know what it is. I don't know where it came from. It's not a patch that should be in the Linux kernel. Because the patches that should be in the Linux kernel
came from people.
Are signed by the latest key of their provenance log that's in the repo and has endpoints that I can check on submission. So when they send me they email the patch, there could be a script that goes, oh, what are all their KYC endpoints? Goes out and checks the rules around the Linux kernel submission policy. Like, is this a human? Okay. Well, our policy for the Linux kernel is there has to be at least three KYC vendors that still agree that they're human and they're still alive and that their results all match, right? So whatever the kernel policy is for submissions can be enforced in real time. And again, because in the interest of transparent upgrades, automatically.
On every appended block to this provenance log.
Or any patch sent to the Linux kernel.
Amazing.
Right, because it has to be signed by a public key in one of the provenance logs already in there. And that provenance log would also have to have like the endpoints in which they can check to the what, not who, to enforce the policies for submitting to the Linux kernel. And I can't stress, these policies don't have to be this complicated. They could be zero policies. But what we've built is sort of like a universal policy engine.
It's a framework for implementing these.
Whatever your policy is, you can encode it. You can build it. And what Cryptid does is they build them for people, for companies. They say, hey, this is our policy set. This is a complicated thing. Can we hire you to build this system to enforce our policies in our internal software processes? The answer is yes, we can. We've built an engine that does this. And it doesn't require a server. It's fully decentralized because... I get to choose if I agree with their policies. So if the Linux kernel's policies are just prove you're human, but you don't have to tell us who you are, we can do that. You can get a zero knowledge proof that says these three KYC vendors agree that you are a person. Okay. But we're not going to see any of their data, right?
You can submit under a pin handle.
It's a single bit. Yes, they're human. So it's not correlatable or anything like that. And so I get to look at what their policies are and decide if I am comfortable with that. So if the Linux kernel is like, just prove you're human, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm totally comfortable with that. I will create a provenance log. I will sign all their agreements. I will submit it to join the Linux kernel. And I will provide endpoints to KYC vendors that I have relationships with that are on their list of KYC vendors that they agree with or that they will accept proofs from, right? So it's just a more, I don't know, it's an agreement system that reflects the real world, and it makes it so that it's all automatable and cryptographically verifiable, and it creates records of everything that happens. So if something goes sideways, we can go back and look at it. And because you can you don't have to ask for permission to create provenance logs, you can have as many of them as you want. So I can make one for my relationship with the kernel. I can make one, you know, with a relationship with another project. And people say, well, what about Sybil attacks? Well, my main interest is my relationship to open source projects. And it turns out, if you think about it, that contribution, meaningful contributions to open source projects are a real world proof of work system. So the amount to which people trust an identity tied to a provenance log is tied to their impact in that community. Have I been a consistent, meaningful contributor to this community for years?
Is this your first pull request?
Or is it my first pull request? Yeah. And so because that's a proof of work and it's not trivial to build that trust, that in and of itself is a check on Sybil attacks, right? Because it doesn't matter. I could make 50 provenance logs or 5,000 of them, but I'm never going to be able to overwhelm the system because the system automatically mistrusts
low history. You don't have an established relationship.
Right. Because
which
you have the
problem in the real world. I trust people that I have an established relationship for. There's ways to short circuit that trust. But you generally trust the people that you have an established relationship with.
Right. Which is why I say your identity actually is the verifiable history of events, that happened in your relationship or interactions with the system. So like you and me, we don't really know each other that well. I don't necessarily trust you very well, but I'll be on your podcast. Seems pretty cool. But I think we're going to be friends for a long time. And we should revisit this in 5 years and say, well, yeah, we've had a lot of interactions with each other. And I know you seem to be a straight up guy now and trustworthy. And I do trust you now. You know, we can talk about that in a few years after we've had a lot of experience. But so your identity in the context of our relationship is actually just that history of our interactions. I don't really care that you're William. I care if you're a nice guy or not. And we can build digital systems that do the same thing. So when you get to this, like, we're going to record it, you know, we're going to have these provenance on data and key pairs and endpoints. And, you know, that's going to be tied to my real world contribution, my real world effort that goes into contributing to like an open source project or writing articles or anything like that. Now we can actually build and transmit trust in a way that is user sovereign because it's private by default. And it's pseudonymous by default, and it's consent-based. If I want to tie that to my real-world identity, I'm the one who chooses to do that, not anybody else. So that's a consent-based relationship. And it's all using open and standard protocols and file formats. It's also using all open and standard cryptography, you know, open-source cryptography, strong cryptography, right? And it's all based around what I am, not who I am. The who part is something I get to choose. So you can see how, like, why it was important to write these principles down. And then that gave us a framework that started off as a straitjacket. I was like, dang, I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't do this. But then once I broke my brain, it was like, well, I don't want to do that because that sends you down the road of like, why can't we use public keys as identifiers? I still argue with people about this today. It's like, and even when I tell them about the web and URLs, they still don't get it because people just freaking love their public keys. And it's like, you don't have a stable enough identifier for there to be a meaningful network that congeals out of the chaos and is stable. It's not a stable system. The public keys as identifiers is not a precondition on which we get stable networks.
All right. So one last question before we go.
Sure.
So for the folks at home who've been listening and their necks hurt from nodding along, how can they get involved? And then to flip that around in terms of what you're looking for contributions and how this is going to, like, what can help accelerate? What kind of introductions are you looking for? What kind of people are you working, like, or wanting to collaborate with? What kind of organizations are you looking for introductions to?
Oh, yeah. So a lot of these ideas are not my own. I'll just say that. This is very much like Bitcoin in the sense that I don't think I've invented anything. I think I've just stacked things in a novel way to create the correct incentive structure for adoption. And I think there's some deep insights that I think that we've come across just by playing around doing R&D and like, why is there the web, but not the web of trust? Like, what are the different preconditions and for the creation of stable networks, right? And just like the deeper understanding and the time aspect of it at all is really important. So the best thing that people can do right now, so I'm the community architect for the libp2p project. So libp2p.io is like our main web hub, and you can find me on Slack and Telegram and things like that. I'm also involved with Cryptid Technologies, and that's cryptid.tech online. The thing that I need the most is people digging into it, trying to understand it, asking questions, kicking the tires. Tell me where we're wrong. I know there's enough here that the answer is in here somewhere. There's enough like new ways of looking at things, deeper understandings that nobody's really ever talked about before. At least I've never heard it. And I've been in open source for 30 years. That doesn't mean that because I haven't heard it, it didn't exist. I mean, I'm not everywhere all the time, but I have been active and engaged for 30 years. And some of the things that we're talking about and writing about and introducing here are things that are like, when you hear it, are like, duh, that seems obvious, but nobody's ever framed it that way. Like stability of identifiers. Well, how would we ever have a web if the URL for a website was changing all the time, right? If Amazon wasn't Amazon today or tomorrow or whatever, it's some other thing and it changes all the time and there's no way to really know. That's a new way of looking at identifiers. And I think there's like several PhDs that could be written here. Like if you want a PhD topic, come find me. I have like six of them. That I could give you, and I can help you find advisors. I know
a lot of folks. That's a pretty generous offer.
Yeah, I truly believe that you get out what you give, right? And I don't care if I get credit for this. I fully recognize that I didn't invent any of this. Just stacking things to try to get an incentive hack. I am trying to build a system that I want to use. And a lot of the challenges that I'm trying to fix came from my time at the Linux Foundation, where we were trying to solve, like, how do we know who's contributing what? And a lot of that thinking, I'm sure, because they're connected to the government quite a bit, you know, they advise the government. They're one of the big open source organizations. And I'm pretty sure that there was a lot of input into the executive order around software supply chain and stuff. And so you can see a lot of these challenges reflected even in the executive order out of that was written a couple of years ago, out of the Biden White House. I just want someone to like care about it as much as I do. I am a very open person and I don't care if I get credit. I really want to just find something that works. And I have been screaming into the void for 7 years, 8 years about this. I've been talking about it at blockchain conferences and web and open source conferences, web conferences and stuff. And everybody just kind of shakes their head and says, you're crazy. And so nobody wrote it. And I was fortunate enough to have some time off and I wrote it. And so now I'm going to kick it out the door, assigning tool and the provenance log library and the WAC, the WebAssembly cryptographic constructs. So the lock and unlock script. API spec and everything. And I'm documenting as a spec. The specs themselves are open. Most of the code is open, like APL too. However, I'm going to try a new experiment and I'm going to release the provenance log library, the WAC library, and the BetterSign tool under the functional source license. Because I'm also very keen on open source funding and experimenting in that realm. I mean, we're going to hear more about that tomorrow at libp2p day when Juan talks about like this new funding model, you know, this network funding thing, and we're experimenting all these different ways to gather resources to pay open source developers. You know, you got like Gitcoin and you've got, you know, grant funding and, you know, we've got DAOs and we've got all these different new ways of doing funding. I'm going to do my part in experimenting by releasing something that I think is fundamental with under a functional source license, which means you can use it in any kind of nonprofit way, open source, whatever, you can contribute to it and all that stuff. And it even grants companies the right to build proofs of concept without paying me. But if they release that proof of concept as a commercial product, there is a license involved. And my primary goal of that license is to fund the maintenance of that software. The specification is totally open. So it, you know, it's a community
from the ground up.
It's under the community specification license. And so if you want to re-implement it, feel free to do so. But we are going to provide written in Rust, optimized, integrated, and it's the open source component of Cryptid's commercial offering, which is like just the basic signing tool, just the basic libraries for managing provenance logs, and you know the library for the API for the scripts, the lock and unlock scripts and stuff. So
then on the Cryptid side,
yeah,
what kind of introductions are you looking for? What would help you the most there, building your business?
Well, Cryptid's success so far has been in name, image, and likeness management, doing the intellectual property management. So remember I was saying NFTs, cryptocurrency or blockchain, managing intellectual property rights for digital data for people who license their digital data.
So if you have data, they should talk to you.
Yes. So if you're...
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. And we're also, I guess at the risk, I don't think this is secret. We can do, because of the provenance stuff, and you can do provenance on messaging, the other part of our success is doing authentic relationship management. So if you're a fan of a star, you can be a legitimate fan club member and know that the communications to you came from the actual star or their people, right? And more importantly, the star, the pop star, famous person, whatever, knows that you're a legitimate fan. You're a human. You're not a bot. Okay. I wrote an article about, you know, trying to angle on Elon because he once said like, hey, anonymity is important, but you know, so is balancing something, whatever. It's on that article. He's basically saying, I need to know you're human, but I don't need to know who you are. This does that. This 100% does this. And it's scalable to billions and billions and billions of transactions because it's late binding trust. It's all real time. And the provenance logs themselves are tiny. And we can use things like distributed storage, like IPFS or S3 buckets or whatever. It's totally scalable. So what our success in right now is name, image, and likeness and authentic relationship management. And what I'm looking for is introductions to people who are in this business. So if you manage people who are famous, we can help you establish authentic relationships between those famous people and their fans and help them manage their intellectual property and through the name, image, and likeness stuff. And these are all commercial products built on top of this open source or this functional source licensed fundamental pieces. Here's one last thing. I know I've said that like five times, but because we can do authentic relationship management, and because this follows the principles of user sovereignty, where you're private by default, I am very keenly interested in partnering with a multiple identity proofers, companies that you'll engage with them. They will verify all your documentation. It's like KYC, but it's a little bit deeper. I want to build a Twitter clone for constituents and politicians. I want to have a system where you go get identity proofed and they identify you're a human. They identify which voting jurisdiction you're in. Are you registered? Whatever. Then when you join, it's pre-populated with all of your elected representatives, everything from the dog catcher down the street to the president of the United States, but just your representatives. And the platform knows nothing about you because what it got was zero knowledge proofs from the identity proofer that you are a human and that you live in this, you know, jurisdiction, this voting district or whatever, right? Because I suspect that politicians can't get a clean signal anymore. No matter what they do to solicit feedback on policy, they get mobbed by bots, right? And so our political system, I think part of the problem, to go out on a limb here, is that the signal's jammed, right? Like they can't get a clean signal from their constituents. I know people say they probably don't even care, but let's say they do. Even if they did care, you know, let's assume they care, they still can't get a clean signal. They can't get feedback from their constituents because even if they hold a town hall, there are paid protesters and rabble rousers who show up and like crash the place. So even if when they try to do it in real time, in the real world, there's protesters and disruptions and all that, and that's just jamming the signal. So what we can build, and we have all of the building blocks, and I'm certain this can be built, is a system in which politicians can say things and they have been verified and there's provenance and all of their constituents can verify the authenticity of the message. And then the constituents can weigh in anonymously about it. And the politicians can know for sure that these are their actual voters. These are constituents of theirs. They live in the district in which they represent. They don't get to know anything about them, but they know that they are their constituents, their voters. So we can give a perfectly clean signal of communication between the elected officials and the people that elected them.
This is the promise of social networking that never manifested.
I guess, but it's probably because we didn't have the preconditions of a stable system that didn't exploit people for profit. And the business model here, I think, is you just have the politicians pay for it because, you know, that's how they're going to stay in office.
They're already doing this to some degree.
Well, I mean, I know politicians and parties pay like $100 for a verified phone number in their one of their districts so they can market to them. You know, so there is money in this system. There is money to be had. And I want to build a platform in which we can have like clean communications between actual humans and other actual humans, first of all, and make sure that those humans are anonymous, verified constituents and politicians. Now, everybody's going to say this is a pipe dream. Fine. I'm going to build it and find out, right?
I love that.
Like, and I need help. I want someone who knows. I need people who are politicians. I need identity proofers that want to deploy some of our software and generate zero knowledge proofs and help onboard people. Call it Save the Republic or something. You know, what is it, Joe Rogan and, you know, was it Elon's like Team Humanity, right? Whatever. I don't know. I don't follow slogans or join on teams very readily, but it seems to me like it would be a great value to society to have a clean way for the voters to talk to the people they voted for. And vice versa. And yeah, I think it would be really cool to try to get something like that off the ground.
Amazing, man. Well,
yeah.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. And I know probably for many of us, speaking for many of us, I think a lot of us want to live in the world you're building. And thank you for building it.
It's not going to be me that makes it happen. I need everybody to help because, you know, I've been working on this for 25 years and some of it's finally coming together. But I anticipate it'll take another 25. I don't think I'm more than halfway yet.
Build it for the next generation.
Yeah, I guess. But thank you. Thanks for your time. I appreciate this and good luck on your podcast. I really hope it works out for you.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you for joining Dave and I today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. To wrap us up, I'd like to leave you with a quote from Bucky Fuller, this podcast's namesake. Something hit me very hard once, thinking about what one little man could do. Think of the Queen Elizabeth again. The whole ship goes by, and then comes the rudder. And then there's this tiny thing on the edge of the rudder called a trim tab. It's a miniature rudder. Just moving that little trim tab builds a low pressure that pulls the rudder around. It takes almost no effort at all. So I said that the individual can be a trim tab. Society thinks it's going right by you, that it's left you altogether. But if you're doing dynamic things mentally, the fact is you can just put your foot out like that, and the whole ship of state is going to turn around. So I said, call me Trim Tab. Thank you for listening. Until next time.